Hi, it's TJ Murphy, Editor-in-Chief of Lava Magazine. Thanks for joining us. Today we have an ultra-running coach and author of the new book, Training Essentials for Ultra-Running, Jason Koop. Jason, thanks for coming on to talk to the Triathlon World for a little bit.
Yeah, not a problem. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and the tagline of the book is How to Train Smarter, Race Faster, and Maximize Your Ultramarathon Performance. And I have a feeling you coach quite a few athletes, Jason, but just to give a little bit of context, I know you've worked with Dean Karnazes, and you, on your book, it mentions some of the elite athletes that you work with, including the likes of Tim Olsen, Dakota Jones, Alex Varner, Jen Benna. And one of the things I found interesting, though, and if you wouldn't mind chatting about first, you started coaching at a pretty young age, and you mentioned it's like a track team or something called the Texas Stars. And I have found over the years that some people are just naturally sort of attracted to coaching or have a gift for it or both. And was that kind of your case? Like what drew you into coaching, and when did you find out you really had an affinity for it?
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely that exposure to both having a coach and starting coaching at a really young age. I mean, I had a pretty neat story where I ran underneath a youth track and field club since I was a teenager. And gradually over the course of, several summers, apparently I had, some level of maturity and or experience, and or I was the oldest kid on the team at the time. And the head coach started giving me some responsibilities to actually start running practices. So, wow. At the age of 16, when I could just start working, I took that on as a summer job, and it was kind of equal parts just babysitting, teenagers on the track in the summer, sure. and then putting together workouts. And then that just combined with having a really good experience as a collegiate athlete at Texas A&M with the team there and the coach that I had there, Dave Hartman, who's just an incredible person and I still correspond with even to today. I just really fell in love with the whole concept of coaching athletes. But the interesting thing is there was really no pipeline to really take advantage of that passion that I had. There was no educational pipeline. There was no kind of professional pipeline. And so I very much had to kind of hack it together through a combination of just experience and talking to the right people and searching out, internships. And that's how I ended up here at CTS. And really kind of as a force of will more than anything else to kind of craft my career path into a professional coach, which I've been doing for the last 17 years or so.
Yeah, and actually, let's mention CTS, that stands for?
It stands for Carmichael Training System. So it's the, company that for the company that I work for now. I started working here as an intern in 2000. And we have a network of over 50 professional endurance coaches that work with cyclists, triathletes, and runners of all shapes, sizes, and abilities, all throughout the country and all throughout the world. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's an interesting thing that the art of coaching is probably more important than ever, considering how much, virtual coaching that's being done or long range coaching via transmitting information through email and websites and power meters and such. I've known a lot of folks that might have had some sort of exercise science background, but that doesn't necessarily translate into very good coaching. You actually mention in your book, you talk about I think you make a reference to what can happen with the problem of extrapolating a coaching method from just a general scientific study. And I wonder if you wouldn't mind commenting on that. I think that we're seeing more of that, or more talk about that, about how, taking on the, we have to look at each athlete as an individual. And is that a philosophy that you've sort of developed over time?
Definitely. We talk about this a lot in our coaching continuing education sessions that we have throughout the company. And, it's getting easier and easier to get more and more information just as, as as this age of interconnectivity and information sharing continues to develop, which is both a good thing and a bad thing. I mean, the good thing is you have access to that information, but the bad thing, and this is actually quite challenging as a professional coach, is to try to filter through all of that information and provide meaningful and actionable advice to an athlete. You can always find a study to support your point of view. I mean, to irrespective of what side of the divide you are on any topic, you can always find at least one, scientific studies to support whatever angle you're trying to get at. And so the real key and the real key in providing an evidence-based solution to providing advice in an athletic setting is to be able to take all of that and filter it down to what it's going to mean to the individual athlete. And that's a really easy statement to make, right? But it's very difficult to do in practice simply because of all of the information that's out there, and a lot of which is contrary to one another, even in a very similar setting.
And I imagine one of the problems is just sort of in working with an athlete to keep them focused and not have them swayed one direction or another by some sort of report that just pops up online that, as you sort of mentioned, there's a lot of crappy reporting and journalism that's a study comes out, and they spend a half hour, reading the synopsis and building a headline, and of course it could be utter nonsense. It could be a poorly done study, and as you sort of mentioned, you can find a study to back up just about any position. And when we get into things like, see, I think ultra running, there's a lot of similarities, and you know more about this than I do, to something like Ironman distance racing, because of the amount of time you're out there and that kind of thing. But it's a pretty complex thing, and to do it not only well, but do it in a way that doesn't break you to pieces. I found something interesting in your approach, and I hope you don't mind talking about it. It's if you go back to the classical ways people have trained for marathons, ultra marathons, long distance triathlons. Step one in a lot of the old books would be just like, okay, start out with low mileage and build up your mileage as swiftly as you can, right? And you kind of like you open up that discussion about what how to kind of perhaps a smarter way to look at what fitness is and what building fitness means.
We used to have this notion that these energy systems kind of built off of each other, right? So first you would build your low intensity energy system, and then you would work on your lactate threshold energy system, and then you would work on your VO2 max energy systems. And by some, magical consequence of physiology, each one of those systems built off of each other like a house. And interestingly enough, when I first started coaching, I used that exact analogy, that house analogy, right? First, you want to build your aerobic base, and that provides the foundation for your house. And then you want to build your lactate threshold, and that's like the framework for the house. And then you want to build your VO2 max, and that's like hanging the pictures and putting all the details and things like that. And I use that analogy many, 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 many times early in my coaching career. It turns out that from a cardiovascular standpoint, we're really not sure if those systems, quote unquote, truly build off of each other. In fact, one of the prevalent theories right now is they actually don't. There is a basis for doing that from a musculoskeletal standpoint, particularly with a newer or an experienced type of athlete. But for an experienced athlete, which most Ironman triathletes fall into, and most ultramarathon athletes certainly fall into, there's really no basis for there's no energy system basis for having to do that. And then you couple that with the fact that that most ultra marathons are a high volume, low intensity proposition for almost any athlete. It makes all the sense in the world to try to tune that low intensity physiology as close to the race as you possibly can. So as a consequence of that, the high intensity physiology, the VO2 max physiology, or whatever you want to do at that time, gets tuned the furthest away from the event because it's the kind of the least specific energy system that you would encounter in an ultra marathon type of situation.
Yeah, you talk about intensity, and it's interesting. As we were talking about offline, I spent some time. I had some good friends that were ultra runners in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I would be training for marathons, and I would meet up with them and the Golden Gate Headlands. And there's one, his name was Gary Hilliard, and I think he's in Southern California now, but at the time he was a great guy that he specialized. I think his favorite race was the 6-day race. Like the gun goes off and you've got a 1 mile loop, and how many times can you go around that loop in 6 days? And you know, one time he averaged 100. He was great, and he was a construction worker. So how he managed all that for as long as he did was pretty impressive. But he would run like 12 or 14 miles to meet me. And then he'd have water bottles there. He'd get his new water bottles, and then he'd go like 18, 20 miles with me, and then he'd run another 12, 14 miles back. And so that was kind of what I was used to, was just seeing these guys that were like cranking up, 160 miles a week. And I don't think intensity was ever part of the program.
Sure, right. Mono intensity, right? One intensity.
Right. As I recall, like Ann Trason's intensity workout was to go do Big Sur marathon. You know, that was like,
right.
Or maybe a 10K. I just think that's interesting. Like from a perspective, be it for an ultra runner or a long distance triathlete, that the upshot of getting in, and you use specificities in a principle that you talk about in your book as well, and being purposeful. But you can really produce some quality gains in your training by being smart about inserting enough, the right amount of intensity. And is that, I guess the worry there is that, I'll get hurt. But what's your sort of advice to we're talking about like a someone who wants to get into ultra running or has been at the long stuff for a while and they want to keep going for a lot longer. How can they get into this intensity thing without too much fear of injury?
Well, you have to do it in a smart fashion. I mean, and we used to think that injuries, particularly in a running setting, was caused by just the sheer amount of volume that an athlete did. So your risk of injury was somehow, if not linearly related to the total volume you did, right? So you do 100 miles a week versus 50 miles a week, and your injury risk goes up by two. We used to think that that was the case, but that turns out that it's no longer the case. And it has more to do with how you actually ramp up your total amount of workload. Mm-hmm. And so that's the biggest thing to keep in mind when you start taking on a kind of a training program, is not necessarily what your maximum training volume or training workload is going to be, but how you in fact ramp that up. And so much so that a high amount of workload or a high amount of volume, or let's just say higher, right? And that's individual for each person, what is high and what is low, actually acts as a protective element against injury. We see athletes more and more often that that have injuries, not necessarily because they have because they're running a lot of miles, but because they ramped up those miles too quickly.
Sure.
So that's the biggest thing when taking those when taking on kind of that proposition of doing a longer event. Interestingly enough, both long distance triathlon, Ironman triathlon, and ultramarathon running kind of share some very similar properties, just in terms of what the intensity looks like. You know, they're similar from a time perspective in terms of how long it actually takes to complete the event. If you take a 10-hour Ironman finisher, which is a very reasonable finisher, right? And you compare that to a 50-mile or 100K event, depending upon the elevation gain, elevation loss. Those two time kind of time properties are very, very, very similar in terms of how long they're going to actually take to complete the event. But the real difference in ultramarathon running is, what does the elevation gain, elevation loss look like? How does that impact the intensity distribution? And one of the first things that I found out when I started to analyze ultramarathon performance is that it's very stochastic. When you look at an athlete who's, an athlete who's doing a 50-mile or 100K or 100-mile race, the intensity distribution is very much dependent upon the elevation gain and elevation loss of the course profile. And the more climbing and the steeper that climbing, typically the greater that intensity distribution is. There'll be higher intensity bouts and lower intensity bouts on the descents and things like that. And so therefore, you have to approach the training a whole lot differently. It's not just a low, slow type of intensity proposition. You have to actually look at what they're going to be doing in race day, which could be, I found that a lot of my really good runners who are doing, 50K, 100K types of events, they can race very, very near their lactate threshold for a long period during a race, even though the race might be 6 or 7 hours. There are good chunks of it where they need to race during their lactate threshold, and so we have to kind of tune that physiology as the race gets closer.
That's amazing. And I know you've worked with Tim Olson, and forgive me, I'm not, does Tim still hold the record at Western States?
He does. Yeah, he does still.
Yeah, and I've interviewed him once before. Truly, I just find him a very appealing person, and it was really interesting to talk to him about how he trains. And one of the questions I have for you, I was asking him about fueling, and which is whether you were talking about the amount of time out there, you're getting to the intensity aspect. But one of these problems that we obviously have, and I every time I've covered the Hawaii Ironman, and I've done it once myself, but I wasn't fast enough to incur some of the problems that the faster athletes have. But you see so many people throwing up, like all over the course. Like they get out of the swim, they get on the bike, some of them try and cram, 5,000 calories down their throat in the first 10 miles on the bike, and I've seen that just spewed up. But even some of the top athletes, they just have trouble absorbing, digesting, and I was asking Tim about how he did things, and he said in his training runs, he wouldn't even take anything with him, that he would just like drink from streams he would find. Obviously, in races like Western States, he was definitely fueling. But this whole gut thing is a real tricky problem. I would never know how to coach someone toward figuring it all out. Perhaps, I know this is a important chunk of your book, you wouldn't mind talking about some of the basics of how to solve these problems so that you're performing well and not shutting down.
Yeah, so interestingly enough, Tim's a really good analogy to that, right? And he mentioned he used to go out on, training runs and not take anything. We've actually changed that. I mean, I just as a matter of context, and to not take credit for things that I shouldn't be taking credit for. Timothy set the record at Western States before I started working with him. It was only
Gotcha.
after he had set that record where he and I kind of paired up, and we've been working together kind of ever since. But one of the things that we focus on with our athletes as they're preparing for ultramarathon events is simply treating their nutrition as a trainable aspect of their training. And more, this is starting to come out in the research where your gut is actually trainable. Your stomach and your small and large intestine they're made of muscle too. It's granted it's smooth muscle and not skeletal muscle. But that muscle, the components of how your digestive system works, actually responds to stress very much in a similar way to how your skeletal muscle responds to stress. You push your skeletal muscle, whether you're lifting weights or running or swimming or whatever, and it responds to that stress in order to, become stronger and more adaptive to the exercise that you're trying to do. Your stomach and your intestines are very, very similar, where if you stress them, it'll respond to that in a positive way so that you can
Fascinating.
absorb more food and absorb more calories. And so we treat that in training as just a component of training, very similar to how you would treat an interval or a hill workout or any other component of training where we need to stress out that system in order to make it better. And so it's very much a conscientious point of the whole kind of the whole training process. And so that's what we have typically will focus on or typically one of the things that we'll have our athletes focus on is simply training it just like they would any other system or any other workout. And then the second piece of it is we've adopted a strategy where we really separate our calories from our hydration. And this is more unique to an ultramarathon type of setting simply because of the length of the duration of the event, where they're going to be consuming a lot of both a lot of calories and a lot of fluid, and the temperature ranges in an ultramarathon typically vary. And so those fluid needs are going to vary with the temperature needs. And by separating the cap, by separating essentially our fueling strategy from our hydration strategy, what it allows our ultramarathon athletes to do is simply not to mix those two up. So if there's a very high if there's a very high dependence on having more and more fluids because it's hotter, it's essentially not messing up their caloric intake. So the combination of those two, simply working on it and training and creating that separation between calories and fluids, that kind of sets the basis for how we strategize our nutrition strategy with our athletes.
So does that sort of mean that following that protocol, it might be easier if I just stuck to drinking water for my hydration and then used solids or semi-solids to get in the calories? Or
Yeah,
is that about right?
we don't normally don't recommend straight water from a hydration standpoint, just because it doesn't contain
Electrolytes.
the electrolytes in it. And plus, if there is a little bit of if there's a little bit of sugar actually in the fluid itself, it helps drive hydration. So normally, we're going with a lower calorie type of hydration drink, or a drink that's specifically formulated to improve the athlete's hydration status, right? Versus a drink that is specifically formulated to deliver calories. Now, from a practical standpoint, what that means is the drink will contain about 70 to 100 calories per 20 ounces. And what
Gotcha.
that is, and like I said, what that enables us to do is to keep the calorie count a little bit lower, such that if they're going through 2 or 3 bottles an hour, it doesn't overload them on the calorie side at the same time.
Cool. And another, I think one of the areas, particularly for triathletes that might be listening into this, and I one of the reasons that I'm it's great to be able to talk to you and talk about your book is that we're not that far from, let's see, we're in July, so we're like halfway through the season, and come October, the season will sort of be over, and triathletes will look for something else to do. And an ultramarathon, as you sort of talk about in your in the opening part of your book, has gained a lot of popularity, and things like Born to Run obviously had an influence on that, and guys like Dean Karnazes, obviously Dean had a huge impact on that and his story on Pam Reed. The but one of the reasons, one of the things that happens though is triathletes have tended, a lot of them used to be runners. They got into triathlon because of their injuries. What about the musculoskeletal aspect of this? How can I build my running form and or my tissues so that I can absorb something like a 50-mile or a 100-mile race?
Well, I mean, if you've been training for long distance triathlon or Olympic distance or Ironman distance triathlon, you likely have already built that up to the extent that you're going to build it up. So I wouldn't say that there's anything extra that you need to do. In fact, that's a common trap that a lot of athletes get caught up in. And what can I do in addition to my training to make me better, stronger, faster? And the very simple approach to that is just to rest. I'm being very serious because
No, right.
a lot of times we tend to add in strength training, flexibility training, and yoga, and cross training, and all of these different things in order to supplement the training process and/or prevent injury. And really, what athletes need to do in order to improve their performance or even just try to stay uninjured is just rest. That is your biggest weapon against preventing injury, is taking the appropriate, deliberate amount of rest. And rest is not getting on the elliptical machine, getting in the weight room. And I know you laugh at it, but
No, I know. I laugh because it's true.
I probably get this question three or four times a week. I have a rest day. Can I go and hit the gym? And the answer is no, because then it's not a rest day. So really, I think the key to unlocking this whole how do I, handle, XYZ type of volume, the first piece of it is to make sure that you're incorporating deliberate and adequate rest. And then going back to a piece that I mentioned earlier, the second piece of it is just to make sure that you're ramping up volume in a reasonable manner. And most experienced athletes that have been through, whether it's a triathlon training program or a marathon training program or whatever, they kind of know their limits. They know what they can handle. As long as you're ramping that up in a reasonable manner, you're fine. And then the next thing that I'll mention is that a lot of people simply get intimidated by the distance or the duration, right? They think, well, 50K, right? It's longer than a marathon. It's an ultra marathon. This tag that goes before the word marathon, ultra, has a intimidating quality to it. Your volume doesn't need to be that unreasonable. I mean, I work with a lot of athletes, a lot of normal athletes that are very, very successful in distances all the way up to, 100 miles, that train off of 6 or 8 hours a week. And that just goes to show, yeah, in fact, a lot, I still coach some Ironman athletes as well. They typically will have higher training volumes than
Correct.
an ultra runner. And so you can be perfectly successful with 6, 8, 10 hours a week, even all the way up to the 100-mile distance, as long as you're being very judicious with where you're placing that volume and that stress. And so don't get caught up in this, oh, I'm doing, 100-mile or 100K race. I now need, and I have been running marathons. I now need to triple or quadruple my volume in order to accommodate for that. That's normally not the case. It's normally, very, very small increases, and strategic increases. That's really the pathway there.
Yeah, no, that's all well said. And the world of triathlon, a lot of type A personalities are sort of drawn to it, and the the hole that can be dug quite easily is when they cut back on sleep to make more time for more workouts, you know. And so they're holding down the 50-hour per week job. They've got a family, and they're getting up at 4 to do their training, and that can work for a while. But you know, there's a when you just sleep and rest are those places where we actually make the gains. You know.
Well, yeah, because just think about it like this, right? The vast majority of injuries in endurance sports, right, are overuse injuries, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm emphasizing the adjective over very intentionally. The fact that we look to additional things to fix overuse injuries is completely asinine when you take a step back and actually look at it. So to say, listen, I'm overusing something, and now I'm going to actually actively go out and do something else to fix that. On the surface, that is that's a very problematic situation, right? Because you're overusing it in the first place. So that's why the first step, whenever you're looking at an athlete who's injured, or you're trying to prevent injury in an athlete, the very first step is to look at what you can take away, not what you can add. And the addition is usually strength training, physical therapy, massage, blah, 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 blah. And those are fine. Yeah. I'm not saying that those are bad. I'm just saying that the first step is rest. Look at where you can incorporate more rest.
Wow.
Then look at where those other things fit into the whole mix.
Yeah, that's great. And I'll let you go, but I do have one more sort of question for you. This is back, 1997 or so, but actually covered the Western States as a journalist. And so my job was just to camp out at the Rucky Chucky River crossing and watch the race, which was a spooky, weird, cool experience. Yeah. But one of the things, so I had a friend, John Menninger, who went on to actually be publisher of Ultra Running, and I think he sold the magazine. But I knew John fairly well. I'd done some running with him, and when I saw him, because I'd been waiting for him, he couldn't even recognize me. Like, I might as well have been. I go, "Hi, John, you're doing great, man." And it was kind of interesting because his eyes were just like, he was in another universe, you know, I think you have to be. But one of the things I observed that night was that it was a great aid station. It was incredible. And they also had a chiropractor there, and they had all these chairs. And I sat down, and some guys sat down in that chair, and they just never got up. And there was one runner who sat down it for a minute. He just said, "I got to get out of this right now." It was really interesting, fascinating, and how that you're at a pretty difficult part of the race where if you allow yourself some measure of comfort, it can be pretty easy for some part of your brain to go, "You know what? We really don't need to go cross that river." I don't know. I'm not exactly sure what my question is here, but the tactical mental toughness part, I think, is a really interesting area of especially like 100-milers. Any particular wisdom you have about, be it Ironmans or 100-milers, in terms of like, you know, crossing those sorts of barriers as you hit them, those low points?
Yeah, I mean, one of the unique things about ultramarathon running is the distance is always going to be so much harder than what you're able to do in a single day of training. And that presents a lot of unknowns, right? It presents unknowns from a nutritional perspective, as we talked about earlier. It presents unknowns from a fatigue perspective. It presents unknowns from a pain perspective. It presents unknowns from a psychological perspective and motivation perspective. So all of those aspects are just so much different because, you know, the typical training day, we'll just take Western States, right, as an example. For your average 24-hour finisher, they might do a long run of like 8 or 10 hours, right? And so they have more unknown than they have knowns.
Sure.
Right? And so it just creates this very interesting thing where you have to learn how to deal with adversity actually out on the trails. And that adversity can be an upset stomach or not recognizing a very good friend of yours at mile 80 of a race, or 100 other types of iterations of that. And so the first thing you can do is just realize you're going to have to go through that, right? Realize that you're going to have to be,
yeah,
you know, really tough, and that you're going to have to face a certain kind of a certain amount of unknowns. Mm. And then the next piece of advice that I would give athletes that kind of run into issues kind of out on the trail, whether they be physical issues or just motivational issues, and usually there's constellation of all of those that are happening all at once, is to really remember why they're out there doing it.
Nah,
you know, these are all elective things that we're doing. Nobody is forcing us to go and sign up for the Western States 100 or the Badwater 135 or any of these things. We all choose to do these. And since it's a choice, it's very easy to pull the plug when the going gets really tough. If you remember why you're out there in the first place, and these are all personal things, you know, sometimes you want to set an example for your kids. Sometimes you're doing it for the personal challenge. Sometimes you're trying to see if you can go, you know, farther or faster than you have before. If you can stick to that, well, first off, if you can formulate that why in training and in training and the preparation for the event, and then use it as a consistent source of motivation during the event,
mm-hmm,
that helps you during those lowest of lows, because they always happen. You know,
yeah.
there's this saying in ultramarathon running that goes, it never always gets worse, which implies just that, right? It never always gets worse, but it also implies that it's going to be bad at some point, right? And even for the best runners on the best days, they have low points,
yeah,
during those races, right? And it's a matter of managing those low points and making sure that they're not too low and they're not too long. That is one of the big keys of success in these ultramarathon races. So yeah, just remember your purpose, and during those low points, kind of pull out that purpose so that you can continue to move forward.
Well, that's great stuff. And again, Jason's book is Training Essentials for Ultra Running. How to train smarter, race faster, and maximize your ultra marathon performance. It's a Velo Press book, and you can also find out more at trainright.com, Carmichael Training Systems, where Jason's coach. Hey, thanks so much for talking with us. I really enjoyed the book, and I should also mention there's templates and plans in there as well. But for anybody who wants to take a break from multi-sport and see what they can do on the never-ending trails, this is a wise book to buy. Thanks so much, Jason. Appreciate the time.
Yeah, thanks, TJ. And I'll have to apologize to your audience, because I did take a swipe at the triathletes out there. One of the I feature a few athletes in the book to kind of bring some of the stories to life. And one of them that I brought to life is a former Ironman athlete. And I kind of poke fun at the fact that he thought Ironmans were too easy, and so he graduated to ultramarathon running. So apologies to your audience in advance.
You don't have to worry about that. It's triathletes, you know, I kind of come from the running side of it. So I've got running buddies that just, this goes back a ways, where they'd see a triathlete at a running race, and of course the triathlete would be wearing neon pink and whatever, and the runners just couldn't handle it. You know, they're just like, who is that guy? Of course, that guy might beat them in the running race. You never know. So,
yeah.
But triathletes are used to being, you know, but they don't mind. We don't mind. It's like, it's fun to just be a part of all of it. So
they make good ultra runners, because once again, they've got the training background. So I think it's a good crossover event. We've seen a lot of triathletes come over into the ultra running world over the last several years.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things is it's just, I think it's just healthy for the long range part of this. I mean, you can do, and I know folks that just do Ironman after Ironman after Ironman, and I'm like, to your point, this is elective. You know, there are the professionals that are making a living, and they're probably trying to do as few as they can and make the best living as they can because they know how, about the beating they're taking there. But it's elective, and you know, it shouldn't be just a sheer sort of satisfying some sort of specific, I don't know, I self-identity thing. To actually go out and explore and try different things is keeps it alive and fun and fresh, and that's why I think taking a break from triathlon to go do something else, whether it's an ultra marathon or, you know, RAM or whatever, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But and you're and also you're right, like you know, the top age group triathlete is putting in 10 to 15 hours of training per week, some of them more, and they're surviving that. They've built a good engine in there somewhere. That's going to translate well if they do some specific purposeful training toward say at a 50K or 50 miler or whatever. So
Yeah, exactly.
well, Jason, great talking with you. Thanks so much for the time, and good luck with the book.
Thank you, TJ. Appreciate it.